From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! To the surprise of the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta, the Indonesian authorities say they will move ahead with the prosecution of U.S. journalist Alan Nairn. He faces 10 years in prison. Also in this week, when Chileans remember the Pinochet coup, we'll talk with a Methodist bishop about what he did next door in Argentina to help the Chileans who fled. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Weeks of horror finally may be ending for the people of East Timor. Hundreds and perhaps even thousands have been massacred since last month's vote for freedom from Indonesia. Some gunfire and new fires are reported in East Timor's already gutted capital today as Indonesian troops pack up to go home. Indonesia is allowing an Australian-led force to come in to restore order. Indonesia was forced to do that by the UN Security Council, and countries like the United States, which after many years of the genocide in East Timor, finally told Indonesia that if they continued the violence, that military weapon sales and the entire military relationship with Indonesia would end. The commander of the Australian force plans to hit the ground tomorrow to be followed by at least 7,000 troops, maybe more. The first airdrop has been carried out, delivering 15 tons of rice today to starving refugees who fled to the hills. Prosecutors rested their case against one of three men accused of dragging a black man to death in Texas, detailing the final harrowing moments of the victim's life. One juror looked away, another winced, and members of James Byrd Jr.'s family seated in the courtroom audience dabbed tears as prosecutors stretched the 24-and-a-half-foot steel chain that was allegedly used as a murder weapon. A video that traced the three-mile route where Byrd died on June 7, 1998, was coupled with a pathologist's testimony as the state wrapped up its case against Lawrence Russell Brewer yesterday. Brewer's attorneys have offered no hint of what strategy they will use when they begin their defense today. Brewer is the second of three white men charged with chaining Byrd to the rear of a pickup truck and dragging him to his death along a country road northeast of Jasper, Texas. This news from Los Angeles: a policeman's conviction for stealing cocaine from an evidence locker has exploded into a wide investigation of a frame-up, drug dealing, and other crimes allegedly covered up by a code of silence in the Los Angeles Police Department. 10 officers and a police supervisor have been suspended in two internal investigations into corruption within the department. And federal authorities announced yesterday they would conduct their own investigation into what's believed to be one of the biggest corruption scandals in LAPD history. The police department declined to detail the allegations against the suspended officers, but unidentified sources quoted by the Los Angeles Times said they're suspected of a variety of crimes, from active participation in drug deals to code of silence violations that allowed delinquent behavior to go unpunished. This news from Tokyo. Revelations over the past few weeks of the slew of crimes committed by police and alleged cover-ups by the superiors have swollen into the worst scandal to hit Japan's police forces in years. With emotions high after a summer marked by an unusual number of high-profile crimes, including Japan's first fatal hijacking and a knifing rampage that left two dead and nearly dozens others injured on a crowded Tokyo street, the timing of the scandal couldn't have been worse. The allegations of police wrongdoing center on Kanagawa, a prefecture just south of Tokyo, where newspapers discovered an officer was fired in December for taking photo negatives held as evidence and trying to force a woman who appeared in them to pay him off and have sex with him. Reports soon followed that two sergeants from a nearby precinct were secretly dismissed in 97 and 98, one for allegedly molesting a woman on a train, the other for shoplifting from a hospital. This news from Paducah, Kentucky. Energy Secretary Bill Richardson has apologized to workers at a government uranium plant in Kentucky. Speaking to a town meeting in Paducah last night, Richardson said the government had not been forthcoming about the possibility of exposure to plutonium at the plant. Richardson also announced a proposal for compensating past and present contract workers at the plant who developed cancer due to exposure to radioactive contaminants. The payout could cost as much as $20 million and must be approved by Congress. Workers at the Paducah gaseous diffusion plant have filed lawsuits claiming they were unwittingly exposed to plutonium for two decades, beginning in the 1950s. And this news from Lusaka, Zambia. AIDS activists and scientists have demanded a greater commitment from African leaders to fight the deadly epidemic sweeping the continent, but it was unlikely the demand was immediately heard. Of 16 presidents invited to attend a four-day AIDS conference of more than 6,300 officials, activists, traditional healers, and scientists, not one, not even host president Frederick Chiluba of Zambia, showed up.
We're lost in the field of information plantation.
Coming back after station identification.
News Goon.
What we need to know.
News Goon.
What we want to know.
We got News Goon.
What we think we know.
Got remote control to choose the show. But the more we watch, the less we know. Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Countless celebrity guests, countless celebrity guests, countless celebrity guests, countless celebrity guests.
So is the news of the people left out? Put a camera in my face just to hear me shout.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Indonesian troops loaded weapons, ammunition, and computers onto Navy ships today, departing East Timor ahead of the arrival of a multinational peacekeeping force. Ending a quarter century of often brutal occupation, that's what the Associated Press called it, often brutal occupation. The commander of Indonesia's troops in East Timor was quoted by the Antara News Agency as saying the army will be withdrawn gradually within a week. That raised hopes for a conflict-free handover to the peacekeepers now assembling in Darwin, Northern Australia, due to arrive in East Timor this weekend or early next week to restore order in a country where the people, the Timorese, have been terrified, killed and brutalized by the Indonesian regime. The peacekeepers' arrival will also allow a full-scale relief effort for tens of thousands of East Timorese who fled the fighting, many of whom are now starving in the rugged hill country. Before we turn to what is happening in East Timor, and more specifically, what is happening next door in an Indonesian province in West Timor, where it is believed up to 200,000 East Timorese refugees have been forcibly deported, we're going to turn to a story we've been following over the last days. Over the last weeks, we've been bringing you daily reports of journalist Alan Nairn, eyewitness reports on the ground in Dili, East Timor. Alan, who defied the army blacklist because he survived the 91 massacre in Dili, where more than 250 Timorese were killed when Indonesian troops with U.S. weapons opened fire. As a result of Alan surviving and condemning that massacre and reporting on it in the New Yorker magazine, he was, along with me, called a threat to national security and banned from entering Indonesia and East Timor. In 1994, we were arrested again for trying to enter East Timor, but did slip in. Alan returned in 1997 and defied the army blacklist once again, revealing that the U.S. government had gotten around a congressional ban on military training and, in fact, was training Kopassus elite Indonesian troops through an obscure Pentagon program. Congress expressed outrage over President Clinton's attempt to get around the congressional ban. And just earlier this year, Alan once again defied the ban and got into Indonesia, where he has been for the last few months, and then went to East Timor, where he's been reporting on the historic referendum that took place on August 30th, in which more than three-quarters of the population voted for independence. In these next few days, international peacekeepers will move in, beginning that second phase of implementation of independence for the people of East Timor. We just got word, though, a few hours ago from the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta that developments in Alan Nairn's case do not look very good. On September 14th, Dili time at 5:30 in the morning, he was walking outside, picked up by Indonesian soldiers at a military checkpoint and brought to Kodam. Kodam is the Army National Command of East Timor. He was brought to the compound where he was questioned, then brought to the police station, Polda. He was further questioned, then brought to Army headquarters and watched as hundreds of militia made their base in the compound, as well as the Indonesian military, once again underscoring the very close relationship between the Indonesian military and the militias. After being in East Timor in custody for a day, he was then jetted off to West Timor, next door, by the Indonesian military, where he was put in immigration quarantine, held in detention, and has been interrogated for the last 2 days. Indonesian authorities said they were doing an investigation and deciding whether to simply deport him or to try him. The U.S. Embassy in Jakarta, as well as the State Department in Washington, D.C., said that it was extremely rare for an immigration case to lead to a trial. In fact, the State Department was telling reporters and Congress members and senators and anyone who called who asked, because the number of calls have been coming in by the hundreds to the State Department, that in fact Alan Nairn would be deported within days. But in the last few hours, we've learned that the provincial chief justice in Nusa Tenggara Timur, NTT, which is the official name of West Timor, an Indonesian province, has decided that he wants to move ahead with the prosecution of the U.S. journalist. I spoke to Alan just a few minutes after learning about the Indonesian official's decision and asked him to explain exactly what is happening.
Well, I was told by the immigration chief that they are moving forward with a court case against me that he said could result in imprisonment. Right now, as we speak, the plainclothes police intel has come in, and they are meeting with the immigration chief about my case.
What are you charged with?
Well, I haven't been formally charged, but they say there are two violations of immigration regulations. What it boils down to is being in Indonesia and occupied Timor in violation of the army ban against me.
Are you surprised by this, and what do you plan to do?
No, I'm not surprised. These are the wheels of the bureaucracy grinding. The immigration chief said they have not heard from Jakarta today, where General Wiranto is expected to ultimately make the decision. And so in the absence of that, they go forward with implementing the regulations. And, you know, the regulations, the gist of them is that, you know, you don't cross the army. You don't defy an army ban, but that is what I did.
What do you expect the process to be like from now on? I mean, in terms of a timetable?
I don't know. I got the impression that it may be a number of days before I go to court as to when I might actually be taken into direct police custody or returned to direct army custody again or open army custody. I don't know when that might happen.
Do you think pressure from the United States would make a difference, or do you think it's out of U.S. hands?
No, I don't think anything like this is ever out of U.S. hands, since the U.S. is the main patron of the Indonesian military. You know, the big issue now is, will the army get out, Indonesian army get out of Timor, and can they be driven out of Indonesian politics so the repression throughout the country will stop? I mean, this is a pretty small matter.
Is there a lot of tension in the room?
Well, the two police intel people who came in looked very grim and hostile. They're in there having their meeting with the immigration chief right now. And actually, we should probably wrap this up now.
Alan Nairn, speaking from the Immigration Center in downtown Kupang, which is the capital of West Timor. Again, just a little while after getting the news that the Indonesian regime had decided to prosecute him for immigration infractions. He is being possibly tried if they do move forward on this, as they say they will, under two subsections of the Immigration Code, 50 and 52. 50 involves overstaying a visa, and 52 involves engaging in unauthorized activities. He's in Indonesia and East Timor, despite an army ban. Well, if you want to learn more about the update on his case as the days go by, he did do an expose in The Nation magazine last week, which you can go to at the web and see his documentation of the U.S. military's relationship with the Indonesian military and the militias. And they also have an update on the status of his case. That's at www.thenation.com. Also, of course, at our website, Democracy Now!, www.pacifica.org. You can hear his daily dispatches, his descriptions of what was happening in East Timor as one of the last journalists who remained on the ground in East Timor. Also, if you're interested in doing something about this case, in Washington, the U.S. State Department is saying they are getting a tremendous number of calls, both from people around the country as well as from senators' staff, senators and Congress members on this case. The U.S. Embassy in Jakarta is feeling tremendous pressure, and you can even do a kind of telephonic storming of the Bastille right at the Immigration Center, because as you heard Alan talking, there is a telephone there. It is a long-distance call, but you can join with groups like the Committee to Protect Journalists. You can go to their website as well at cpj.org to find out the latest on his case. You can join with those groups and our news organization as well as many others who are condemning the Indonesian regime for trying to remove another set of eyes and ears, a window on the Indonesian occupation of East Timor. The number of the immigration center in Kupang, West Timor is 011-62-380-831-880. And you can ask why they're moving forward with a prosecution. That's 011-62-380-831-880, and ask why it is that the Indonesian military puts reporters on the blacklist because they've survived massacres and reported on them. Well, that takes care of this segment and the reporter that's been bringing us a lot of this news, but we're going to go right now to what's happening in the area where he's being detained, and that is West Timor. Most importantly, what's happening to the upwards, perhaps, of something like 200,000 Timorese refugees. The UN has estimated that perhaps three-quarters of the Timorese population have been displaced. Hundreds of thousands in the mountains of East Timor. It's dry season. Tremendous concern about hunger and thirst as they've taken to the hills to escape the Indonesian military and the militias. They've also been forcibly deported into West Timor, and we're going to speak with two people, one who has documented what is going on in West Timor, the other who is attempting to do something about it with his group Timor Aid. We're joined right now by David Oddly Smee, who is the head of Timor Aid. Welcome to Democracy Now!, David.
Good evening.
What is the latest that you've heard from West Timor?
We estimate there's 200,000 people there out of 700,000 East Timorese people. It's a big population. In the whole of West Timor, we estimate there's 23 camps, and that is round about 10,000 each camp on average. The chances are that those people are given no food. We have this from the pattern of Indonesian camps in 1976 to 1979 and more recently this year. They're given no food and they have to fend for themselves, which is really means begging or running out to steal or something, and of course they get no medicines, and of course they were brought here by gunpoint, and therefore they have no belongings and no money. And most of them, not all, certainly not all, but there's a very large percentage of women and children, because the men were inclined to run to the mountains of East Timor while the women and children were deported, with old people, of course.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Doug Strzok, who is a reporter for The Washington Post, who did a piece we talked about a few days ago on the front page of The Washington Post on Saturday. Some of the first stories to come out of the countryside of East Timor about massacres that have taken place there over the last few weeks. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by David Audley Smee with Timor Aid. He speaks to us from Darwin, Australia, which is just about a 45-minute to an hour plane ride from East Timor. Also, Doug Strzok is with us from Darwin as well, though he had spent the last days in West Timor before he moved to Darwin, where he will follow in the multinational force that will go into East Timor in the coming hours. Doug Strzok, a reporter for The Washington Post. Doug, why is it that these refugee camps, because I think people's last picture of refugee camps was the ones of Kosovar Albanians in places like Macedonia, are run by the Indonesian government and not run, for example, by the International Committee of the Red Cross? After all, they were forcibly deported by the Indonesian forces.
Well, I think the answer to that is that it's simply still Indonesia, and the international aid organizations really require permission to operate from the Indonesian authorities, and the Indonesian authorities say, with some legal justification, that they believe that they have the right to take care of these refugees, and they are able to do so, and so they have been reluctant to, up to now, to grant free access to the international aid organizations. Now, that is changing. Just today, there was a promise by the Indonesian government that the United Nations High Commission on Refugees and UNICEF and some of the other organizations will be allowed into the West Timor camps. Remains to be seen. Promise will be kept, but that's what's been said today.
How hard was it for you to cover what was happening in the refugee camps, not to mention simply to talk to refugees about their stories inside East Timor?
Well, it was extremely difficult and extremely frustrating because the camps have are in effect controlled by the militia. And more than that, there has been whipped up among the refugees this whole anti-foreigner sentiment, such that even when one found refugees who might be in a position to talk, might be a little bit away from the crowd, they were nevertheless very afraid to do so. Some of them exhibited what I think is a genuine hostility toward all foreigners, and others simply were afraid that if they were seen or caught or heard talking to foreigners, that they would suffer some sort of repercussions. So we did have to find refugees who were courageous. We had to find refugees in private places where they could talk secretly, and that was difficult to do.
Tell us about Sister Barudero, the woman who escaped from Swai, a city south of Dili, East Timor.
Sister Mary Baradero was one of those courageous people who was willing to allow her story to be told with her name attached. Most of the refugees that we talked to were afraid of giving their names for fear of repercussions. She and other nuns were in the town of Suai, which is in western East Timor, when militiamen surround, and this is, you have to understand, a church that is run by Catholic priests and became, as most of the churches did, a sanctuary, a refuge for people who had been terrorized by the militias in that area. This particular church was filled with women and children because, as you heard, the men had already fled to the hills when the militia surrounded. According to her account, the militiamen first started shooting into the church, and one of the priests, Father Duanto, stepped out in his clerical robes to meet the threat and was immediately shot down. He was followed by a young Jesuit, Father Hilario, Father Francisco, who was similarly executed, and then the militiamen went in and found the chief parish priest, Father Hilario, who had worked with the refugees for years in that area and was very well beloved. He was killed, and then the massacre took place in earnest. The militiamen, according to her account, came to the door of the church where the women and children were huddled inside, and opened fire with automatic weapons. They followed that with three hand grenades that they launched into the church, and everyone was killed. The Vatican has confirmed this account, her account of this massacre. The Vatican puts the death toll at about 100. Sister Mary was unsure of how many were in there, but it's clear there were an awful lot of casualties.
When you talk about people like Sister Baradero being afraid to speak, what is it exactly that they're concerned about, that the militias that run the camps will figure out where they've come from and what kind of violence they've fled?
Yes, that's the simple answer. It is many of the refugees have families that are split up, that are splintered, that are all over the countryside. They really don't want to have their names published anywhere, even though it might be unlikely that militia leaders in East Timor are reading any American newspaper. They still are afraid that if somehow they're identified as speaking out or speaking against the militia, that their family members might be found, might be in some of these camps or somehow under the control of the militia leaders, and that they could be harmed, or that they personally would be harmed. There are a number of people who are refugees who are hiding in church refuges, in places where the church leaders have put them, in private houses in Kupang, West Timor, and they report that militiamen had last week been making the rounds to try to find individuals. They had names of people they were looking for, and they also were trying to find members of the church, of the Catholic Church, whom the militiamen feel have been too heavily involved in politics on the side of pro-independence.
Right.
I have to say that there are no confirmed instances where we know of in which any of these people in West Timor have been harmed, particularly in Kupang. In Atambua, which is in West Timor but right on the border with East Timor, there have been two murders that we know of. But in Kupang, we don't know of any violence. But nevertheless, these people are very afraid of speaking or being even seen with any foreigners, journalists, aid workers. The aid workers who are going in there are Indonesian. They have to, for example, the UNICEF people who go in there have to strip off the UNICEF signs from their cars and sort of pose as members of the Indonesian Social Welfare Ministry.
Is this because the militias are going after them?
Yes, it's because they fear the militias. But you have to understand that there is this whole climate of anti-foreigner sentiment that has been built up among the refugees, certainly fostered, certainly encouraged by the militias, but it's taken on a life of its own. The sort of warped logic of it is all of our troubles, all of our, meaning East Timor, all of our troubles were somehow caused by the United Nations observers for the election who were biased.
Well, that,
if it weren't for,
that is exactly what the militia say, right? I mean, the people of East Timor.
That's true. This is their line, that the UNAMET was biased, and UNAMET was foreigners, and therefore all foreigners are the cause of our problems. But I think, to be fair, we have to say that a number of refugees do believe this. This is not simply totally intimidation on the part of militia. I think there are people who honestly believe it.
David Audley Smee, what's your take on this, of Timor Aid and Darwin, who's heading into West Timor to help many of the refugees?
We're concerned with two things in Kupang and in Atambua. Number one is to get a number of refugees out of West Timor, because our thinking is that it's very unlikely that for the next 20 years they're going to leave 200,000 people in camps, in 20 different camps throughout West Timor. And so it's extremely likely that they're going to ship them out, as they've already started to do in small quantities, into other Indonesian provinces where their allegiance to Catholicism will be shattered, their allegiance to Portugal will be shattered, and their sense of being a separate East Timor people will also be shattered. And so we're extremely concerned about, obviously we can't help 200,000 people, but where there are people who are known to be targets, we're doing our best to evacuate them. Our plans, and we haven't evacuated any to Darwin, but that's on the plan, but we have evacuated some to other places, and I won't say where, but this is to get them out of the hands of the militias who are attacking. And of course our other branch of our work is to help with emergency relief for the people who are in West Timor. Now, as your other informant was saying, and rightly, there's an awful lot of people in camps, and they're extremely scared. We, being a fairly small organization, we're not like the United Nations, are not in a position to challenge the militias. And so, knowing that, and we have a lot of evidence and partners in Kupang who tell us this, knowing that there are many people in houses and other places, in other words, not in camps, but yet extremely hungry. An example would be 80 people in one particular place that I know of, 85 people, and they're relying on very few resources, then we intend to help them without endangering them or without endangering ourselves, because our aim is not to sort of put ourselves in a position where we're chased out of the place, but to continue work in a very quiet underground way. So our two targets are evacuating people on the one hand and then emergency relief work. At the same time, we're sending in a ship from Australia, probably two ships, and they'll be leaving within the next few days, and they'll be landing at places where it's possible to land. This might be Dili, depending on the circumstances, in a few days, but being tank landing ships, which open their bow doors at the front and allow out vehicles and so on. These ships can land on beaches, and there's a number of beaches, not many in East Timor and West Timor, but a number, a sufficient number to land stuff. Now, I don't know if we're going to be dramatic in doing that. All I'm saying is that we are sending in ships, and they will land wherever it's possible to land. And in those ships are obviously emergency relief food and so on. And by no means are we the only people doing this sort of thing, but probably we're one of the few doing it in this particular way. But in addition to the emergency relief from food and medical supplies, we're sending on another ship, we're sending medical personnel who are associated with a Portuguese group and an Irish group, but particularly the Portuguese, who belong to Assistência Médica Internacional, which is a group rather like Médecins Sans Frontières. And so they do, in other words, they're medical personnel, and they will go in and start to do emergency medical work in association with the medical goods that are being sent on the other ship.
This latest news we have of the Australian-led forces moving in the next perhaps 24 hours into East Timor. Doug Strzok of the Washington Post, can you explain what exactly is happening, what you see in Darwin? And is it true that the Indonesian military is pulling out as opposed to staying on the ground and being there in addition to the multilateral force?
It does appear from the reports we've gotten that the military is starting to pull back, and that the militiamen, who had been so much in evidence and had caused so much destruction, are starting to melt away into the hills, or perhaps change uniforms, who knows exactly. But they are also starting to disappear. We've heard from a few people who are in Dili who say that the streets are practically deserted and empty, and that the riflemen are not so much in evidence anymore. I don't imagine that the entire Indonesian military is going to withdraw completely before the multinational force appears, but the local military commander of the Indonesian forces has said that shortly after they come, he hopes to withdraw his forces within a week. That's something that hasn't been confirmed from Jakarta, because, as you know, Jakarta still considers this formally a province of Indonesia until the National Assembly approves the results of the referendum, expected, I think, in November. So officially, this is still a part of Indonesia, and Jakarta has not said that it would abandon it quite so completely. However, that seems to be what's happening on the ground. It seems that the Indonesian military is leaving. It's caused the United Nations peoples to begin to plan to take over civilian functions of the municipal government there, which they had not planned on doing quite so quickly. And it's also prompted at least some relief on the part of the multinational force that's going in, that they won't have to fight their way in.
We're talking to Doug Strzok of the Washington Post, speaking to us from Darwin, Australia, and David Audley Smee with Timor Aid. David Audley Smee, if people want to get in touch with Timor Aid, tell us what kind of organization it is and where they can reach you, perhaps on the web or email, or even possibly a phone number. Maybe you even have one in the United States.
We don't have one in the United States. We have a partner in the United States called Counterpart. You know, this time of the evening in Australia, I don't have it right in front of me. It's in New York. We're involved in emergency relief when there's droughts and when there's economic crises. And, of course, now. But more normally, we're involved in seven particular fields of development, the most important of which are education and health. If people do want to get in touch with us, we can guarantee that the money gets through. We're in touch with, and we work with, partners in East and West Timor, some 30 partner groups consisting of the Catholic Church, the Protestant churches, and various independent NGOs. And our number is, in Australia, our telephone number is 618, that's Australia and our province, 8948 1-800-878-5858. And the fax number is 618-8948-4498. And our website is, and we believe, frankly, it's the best in the world. It's updated daily, and it's read by people all over Europe, including prime ministers. And it's www. There's two. It's www.timoraid.org, and there's www.timortoday.org. I think I've got that right.
Well, we'll also have it on our website, and we'll check it out before we put it up at www.pacifica.org. We put the contacts of guests who have organizations that you can get in touch with. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. David Audley Smee of Timor Aid, based in Darwin, Australia, just about an hour's flight from East Timor, and Doug Strzok, reporter for The Washington Post, who plans to head in with the multinational force that may be arriving, within hours, or at least a day, in East Timor. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we return, we're going to hear the story of a young woman here in the United States who's serving a 25-year sentence in federal prison, and, well, you'll find out why. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In the headlines of the news, we said we would take a look at Chile and the fallout now on the anniversary of the Pinochet's rise to power in 1973 and the coup against the democratically elected president of Chile, Salvador Allende. But we're going to put that interview off to bring it to you in full on Monday. And today we're going to follow up on an event that took place yesterday in Washington, D.C. The Congressional Black Caucus held a legislative hearing on drug laws. Now, we've been hearing a lot about drugs recently, not only because of the media's coverage of the so-called war on drugs, but because of the Republican candidate for president, George W. Bush. Did he or didn't he? The question is, if George Bush was involved with drugs in his lifetime, should we know about it? And what should be done about it. But for us, it's raised a lot of questions about who is in jail on drug crimes and for drug crimes, and we've been looking at a number of those cases. Today we ask, does the punishment fit the crime? And that is a question about the case of Kemba Smith. She's 27 years old. And yesterday her parents spoke at the Congressional Black Caucus hearing. They are leading a national crusade to call attention to federal mandatory drug sentencing laws that led to their daughter's sentence. Their daughter sentenced 25 years in federal prison, and we'll find out now why from Gus Smith, Kemba Smith's father. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mr. Smith.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on. We also have my wife, Odessa Smith, on the other line.
Odessa Smith, welcome as well.
Thank you.
Well, why don't you tell us the story of your 27-year-old daughter, Kemba Smith, and why she's behind bars.
Okay, Kemba just recently turned 28 in August. Kemba's a very bright, intelligent, articulate young lady who we raised, our only daughter, and we raised her and gave her a good set of values, brought her up in a good, wholesome home. But she's very naive because we kept her close rein on her. To make a long story short, Kimber went off to Hampton University in Hampton, Virginia after she graduated from high school. And she met a group of young ladies, and one of these young ladies introduced her to a young man named Peter Michael Hall, who at the time was posing as a student, but he was not a student. Kimber did not realize this. Another fact that she didn't realize that Peter Michael Hall was a major drug dealer, who had a $4 million crack cocaine operation. So after Kimber had started seeing him, he started to abuse her, physically abuse her, mentally abuse her, to the point where she had to seek medical treatment, where we had medical records to prove it. And late in the relationship, she found out that he was a drug dealer, and she also found out that he had murdered his best friend, because he thought his best friend was working with the government to try to capture him. Peter also came to our house on an occasion, Christmas, for Christmas dinner. I met him. He was very articulate, well-mannered, well-dressed, no gold chains, no big cars. He was driving a Honda. Said all the things that a father would want a young man dating his daughter to say. Lo and behold, I didn't know the story. I didn't know he was a drug dealer. I didn't know that he had murdered his best friend. I didn't know any of this. And, you know, he controlled Kimber through abuse. And as a result of Kimber's involvement with her, she received a 24-and-a-half-year sentence. She did things such as putting a car in her name for him, or an apartment. And this constitutes conspiracy at the federal level when you're dealing with the government and federal conspiracy charges as it relates to a drug charge. And because of that, things like that, she received a 24-and-a-half-year sentence. She pled guilty because Peter was found dead after she gave the location of where Peter was. When the feds got to him, he was dead, so they decided to prosecute her. In the meantime, they always told us and told Kimber that they didn't want her. They didn't want her. All they wanted was Peter. But yet, when they found Peter dead, they decided to prosecute her. So now she's serving 24-and-a-half years in Danbury Federal Court. Without the possibility of parole.
Did they allege she had something to do with his death?
No. She had nothing to do with his death. The prosecutor also said in court during her plea, during her sentencing, that Kimber never sold, used, or benefited from the sale of drugs. But because of federal mandatory laws, which basically says if you aid or abet anyone in any way in an ongoing drug enterprise, you can be and will be treated just as if you were a drug kingpin yourself.
We're talking to Gus Smith, who's the father of Kimba Smith, who really has become very well known in the circles of people who are fighting against mandatory drug sentencing laws. Kimba's parents, Gus and Odessa Smith, leading a national crusade to change those laws. Now, Odessa Smith, when she put the car in her name or the apartment, whatever, did she understand she was doing this to cover up a drug operation?
Questions like that are very difficult for me to answer because I really don't know the correct answer. All I know is what I've read in the Emerge magazine. These are that are going on that went on in my daughter's life that we knew nothing about. This is why it is very painful and very difficult for us to understand, but all of these things that Kimba did, she did it under duress because these are things that Peter told her to do, and if she did not do them, then she knew what would happen, and that was that she would get a beating. And these were the mitigating circumstances in Kimba's case that were never taken into consideration.
Did they even allow the testimony?
In the court?
Yes.
That's what we've been asking for, and that's what we've been denied. No, Kimber has not had an opportunity to present any evidence in court about why these things were done.
How many years has she served so far?
Kimber has been in prison already 5 years.
Did
which is too long, too long.
What
real crime is to continue to incarcerate my daughter, who deserves to be home with her four-year-old son and with her family?
Did the prosecutor push for the 25-year federal sentence?
Yes, he did. In the pre-sentence report, called for a sentence of a maximum, I think, of 27 years. And she got 24 and a half. See, the prosecutor has all the power in federal drug cases. The judge has no power. All the judge can do is administer the sentence based on the sentencing guidelines. The prosecutor basically predetermines what your sentence will be. And when you go before the judge for sentencing, he just reads your sentence. And when you go, if you go to trial before a jury, the jury doesn't know what your sentence is going to be. All the jury is read is this is the law, and this is what the law says. Based on the law, did this person break the law? So, like I said before, example, if I'm a drug dealer, and I ask someone to take me to the bank, and they know that I'm a drug dealer, and they help me in any way, if they take me to the bank to make a deposit, they can become a co-conspirator. Mm-hmm. And if I'm dealing, let's say, 100 million pounds of crack cocaine, then that person who takes me to the bank can get life in prison with no parole, just for taking me to the bank. And this makes no sense. This is ludicrous. When we have robbers, murders, rapists that get very little time. By the Justice Department's own statistics, the average murder in this country receives a 12-year sentence. So are we saying that in Kimba's case, that her sentence, what she did was twice as bad as murdering two people? It makes no sense. And it's a burden on the families, the devastation, financially, emotionally, not to mention the taxpayers who are footing this bill. To keep people like Kimba, who's a first-time offender, never been in trouble before, for 25 years, who's no threat to society at all, who's very intelligent, very bright, has a young kid at home that she could be raised and could be contributing to society.
Last month, a federal judge in Norfolk, Virginia, denied an appeal seeking a new trial for Kimba, saying her part in the drug trafficking conspiracy was direct and extensive. What is your response to that?
This same judge, a few months ago, wrote a brief in which he stated that he felt that Kimba's sentence was too harsh and that her case was worthy of a review. And now here it is, several months later, he does a complete 360. And I can't figure out, or anyone else can figure out, why. Elaine Jones and the NAACP is handling Kimba's case now, the Legal Defense Fund, which was set up by Thurgood Marshall years ago. And nobody understands why this judge has turned around on her case completely. It makes no sense. Where he had the same information then that he had when he made the decision.
What do you think is the bigger picture here, the motivation for these extremely harsh federal mandatory drug sentencing laws? Odessa Smith, what's your thought?
I guess my initial thoughts right now are that it's out of control and that someone, the American people, really need to take a look at issues such as this and what's going on in this country, because until it happened to us, we never knew that anything like this ever existed. And for this to be going on in this United States of America, in itself, to me, is a crime. That's my opinion of it.
Where is Kimba imprisoned?
In Danbury, Connecticut.
Yesterday at the forum that took place as part of the annual Congressional Black Caucus meetings in Washington, what was the focus, and were there other parents like you there?
There were other parents there like us, and the focus was on federal mandatory drug sentencing and to educate the public about what's going on and how harsh it is and how it doesn't make sense. And to talk about Congresswoman Maxine Waters' bill, H.R. 1681, that will repeal mandatory sentencing. But even though this bill will not help Kimba because it's not retroactive, but we strongly support this bill because it makes no sense. It's just devastating in a country where we talk about our children and that's the most important part of our future, but yet we incarcerate young people at a phenomenal rate, especially people of color, which have most of them, especially the women, 80% of the women who were convicted on drugs have children. And what happened to these children? Unfortunately, Kimba's child, who was born while she was incarcerated, has a support system, has my wife and my and the entire family to support him. But there are children out here in foster homes being transferred from relative to relative that will go right behind their parents and wind up one day in prison. So it kind of perpetuates itself. It's not a solution. We need Congress to repeal this law because the law does not work. All the statistics show, the RAND report, they all show that it doesn't work. We need to be smart on crime instead of being tough on crime. We need treatment. We need education. We need to start working with our young folks as early as the first grade to talk to them about peer pressure, self-esteem, conflict resolution, all the issues surrounding people taking drugs and going to prison, and give people treatment instead of locking people up who have a drug habit. We can't win this war unless we get right to the source. In other words, we need to work on the demand side. We need to get people off of drugs, give them free treatment, and then we can stem the supply side, because as long as there's a demand in this country, we will never win the war on drugs.
So you said the bill that Maxine Waters, a Los Angeles Congress member, has introduced is 1681, and it would repeal mandatory drug sentencing.
Drug laws.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. If people want to get in touch with the National Crusade that you are a part of to try to end mandatory minimums, as they're called, where can they call?
Okay, they can call us at our foundation, which we've set up, the Kimba Smith Youth Foundation, which the phone number is area code 804-730-1123. Or they can go to Kimba's website. And the website is very long, but I'll tell you an easier way to get there is to go to any search engine and type in Kimba Smith, K-E-M-B-A, Smith, and it will take you to the Kimba Smith Justice Project.
Well, Gus and Odessa Smith, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we wrap up today's program. Democracy Now! Produced by David Love, Donna Neiman, and Maria Carrion. Errol Maitland is our technical director. And for those who are calling in once again to get the phone number in Indonesia, in Kupang, Indonesia, for the Immigration Center, where Alan Nairn, journalist detained, is now being interrogated, and was just told that, in fact, in an unusual development for a person charged with an immigration violation, his case will be brought to court, and again, to the surprise of the U.S. Embassy, that he will be prosecuted and faces up to 10 years in prison. You can call the Immigration Center itself at 011-62-380-831-880. That's 011-62-380-831-880. Consider it a storming of the Bastille telephonically. Also, Congress members and senators now are receiving hundreds of calls from people around the country to pressure the State Department and the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta to pressure the Indonesian regime, long its client. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Democracy Now!